The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Most of you are city dwellers, and you're living in the midst of one of the greatest revolutions in all history, that of city living and city dwelling. Leading some of the big urban planners, architects, and engineers to ask the question, why not just destroy all of our big cities, and they mean by this New York, Los Angeles, Detroit, Chicago, all of them, and start all over again. Recently, Philip C. Johnson, who is a distinguished architect, said, the last generation of Americans made the greatest mess of all of the history of the world in its cities and what he called its loathsome towns. And he said we still had plenty of money to start all over again, and he advocated doing precisely that. In remarks he made before the Women's National Democratic Club, Mr. Johnson said that the generation that had ruined America was his generation, and he added that he was now 60 years of age. He proposed that the rebuilders start with the nation's capital, and estimated this would only cost about $2 billion. Now, should you take such a proposal seriously? Are we really in the middle of a crisis in our big, growing megalopolises of today? According to some of the seers that try to take the pulse of big city living and tell us precisely what the problems are and try to prognosticate what the future may be, our big cities are relentlessly strangling themselves in any number of several ways. New York City, said Lewis Mumford, who is a community planning pioneer and an authority on urban civilization. New York City, he said, is relentlessly strangling itself and is probably entirely too late to do anything about it by simple means. Now, he asserted these criticisms that the city in which he was reared and from which he has now fled, incidentally, and escaped to Dutchess County. He said New York has far too many skyscrapers. He said the newer ones are just glass and metal filing cabinets. He talked about inordinate congestion. He talked about the utter incapability of New York City in solving its congestion problems. And he says, for example, the proposed World Trade Center is sheer disaster. And those other huge office buildings in Midtown, he called them sheer madness. But just what are our big cities of today really like? What are they doing to us? What is city life like for all of us who live in the big cities? And is it really sensible to propose destroying the big cities and starting all over again? Now, a top authority on urban planning told a Senate panel recently that Senator Ribicoff's $50 billion proposal for rebuilding U.S. cities would turn urban America into a high-rise nightmare. They say that it's necessary. They say to remove some of the poverty-stricken areas, all the Bedford-Stuyvesants and the lots of the big cities of today. We've got to have the new high-rise apartments. We've got to have freer travel. We've got to have some method to solve all of the waste and the rubbish disposal problems. We've got to solve the problems of smog, of the pollution of our atmosphere, the pollution of our water. We've got to solve all the problems of decentralizing the terribly crammed and jammed and crowded conditions in our big urban centers. These and a host of other dizzying problems, they say, we have got to solve, and furthermore, they claim we're running out of time. Now, let me tell you that it's quite accurate the way these men try to appraise the problems of cities. It's exactly like trying to give you some kind of a prognosis on a patient, because they can literally take the pulse of a city. Now, for instance, in New York City, they have X number of places where they're disposing waste. The one who is in charge of this has gone to these precise places, and he has said that New York City has only about 8 years left before it strangles itself with the problem of waste disposal. Because, look at this, we are not a consumer society, we are a using society. By that I mean that we do not really consume what we utilize as a so-called consumer society. Now, in days gone by, New York City used to have pigs, way back, of course, in the 1700s, that walked in their unpaved streets. And these were public garbage disposal units because what was being consumed then was truly consumed. And even in World War II society, where cardboard and tin, that these were the containers that were used mostly to package our goods, this was still somewhat true. Tin would finally corrode and go back to the elements, and so would cardboard finally disintegrate. But today, whether you're a golfer on the golf course following your endless trails of little white plastic filter tips that just will not dissolve through drought, flood, or what, and trying to pick out your white golf ball among all of these things, or whether you're driving up and down the freeways and finding all the plastic bottles and the rubber tires and all the different types of metals and the different types of materials that are being used in our not consumers but users society, where the changing of style can cause someone, after he just uses something a year or so, to cast it off, and it becomes so much waste that has to be trucked or hauled somewhere else. Now, they have X number of disposal yards in New York City for getting rid of all this monumental pile of waste. And they can tell you that at the present rate of piling waste on top of waste, they have 8 years left to solve the problem, but there's no place else to take it. Now, that sounds like a way-off problem to many people, the mere problem of waste disposal of some of today's cities, but that's only a part of the picture. So I want you to take a quick look at what today's cities are really doing to people, because today's number one domestic problem facing America is the rush to the big cities. I talked in recent programs about the population explosion and brought out as one aspect of the population explosion the fact of the shifting of massive numbers of population to the big urban centers, and now the almost frenzied efforts of people in urban renewal and decentralization to try to take care of these increasing millions of people in the big megalopolises of today, and to free up these big urban areas, and to solve some of the terrible problems as a result of the overcrowding. Now, the rush to cities is America's number one domestic problem. Our cities are rife with unsolved and apparently insoluble problems of smog, water pollution, overcrowding, noise, poverty, mounting crime, and a new thing that is emerging on the scene, the disease of, you might call it, cityitis, of what it's doing to our minds and our nerves, of what it's doing to us as human beings to live in the midst of an enervating, jangled, snarled, sort of a festering scab of smog-bound, lung-destroying, smoke and choking, gaseous, noxious mixtures that we like to call cities. Now, smog is being blamed by public health officials for the high and the rising incidence of all kinds of strange diseases, bronchitis, emphysema, even lung cancer among city dwellers. And smog all by itself is one of the really big problems of this age and this day. All of you have heard, sooner or later, about the smog problem even of such formerly well-known health spas as Phoenix, Arizona, of all things. And cities that formerly you would never think of having smog, such as Denver, Colorado, now because of our increased industrialization and the centralization of populations, causing smog problems in areas where formerly they were never thought of. Now, psychiatrists are placing considerable blame on the emotional strain, the enervating tension of scrambling back and forth on these giant complexes that we call freeways, nothing free about them. It's like one fellow said, it's getting so bad now that one of these days we're going to have to try to get a reservation to make a left turn on the freeways. And it's also getting so bad that one joke that was passed around is that just as soon as they cut the ribbon for a new section of freeway, the first thing that happens is they have a traffic jam. All the radio and the TV now tries to give you all the sig alerts and the various freeway areas to avoid, because one little accident can jam traffic for 10 miles. And we're familiar with some of these problems, but most of us don't try to take the pulse of the city to find out what we're doing in it, and should we stay there, and if we do, what is this city going to be like the next 3 years or 5 years from now, and is this city of the future, the city of tomorrow, going to be good for us? Is it something we want? Now, if you ask the average person, what is he doing in a city, he'll probably tell you, well, because that's where the money is, because he's there to earn a living, because he has to be there. And large numbers of them will say that the only reason they are there is because they have to be there. Others, I suppose, would tell you that they like city life. This is the most difficult for me to understand, but then you might say that's my own private opinion. Now, dirty air, or smog, is one of the biggest problems for people living in cities today. The air that we breathe. You've heard special documentaries on it, you've read about it, and of course you breathe it every day. So I'm not telling you something you don't know about. It smells bad, it tarnishes metals, it destroys trees and foliage, it ruins paint and causes it to come off your home too early. It kills crops on farms hundreds of miles away, and it plays a role in serious illnesses of the heart, lungs, and circulation. A recent public health survey by the United States Public Health Service reveals that every American city of more than 50,000 population has a present air pollution problem. And precious little is really being done about it to solve the problem. Rather, increasing urbanization, increasing industrialization, increasing numbers of automobiles are merely apparently adding to the problem, in spite of all of the laudatory moves of trying to install various gadgets on automobile exhaust to take away some of the causative factors of smog. But that's just a part of the problem. Now we hear about filthy water. And this is something that almost makes you sick to hear about it, because according to Interior Secretary Stuart Udall, he said that growth and spread of urban and industrial communities bring continually closer together the sewage outfall of one community and the water intake of the next one downstream. Now this is a fact, that at least 50 million people in the United States are drinking second-hand water. Kind of an obnoxious statistic, I agree, but nevertheless true. And a public health service expert has estimated in some of these areas they may even be drinking fourth or fifth-hand water. Now that means that the water that has been used to carry off wastes, all that this word entails to you, whether private, personal, or industrial, from one community has then gone through a treatment plant to make it, quote, fit, end quote, for another community. It goes downstream. That community uses it for its personal and industrial purposes. Then this is treated and goes downstream, and another community uses it, and so on. This is so true in the Midwestern areas, where our big water drainage basins of the Mississippi River, for example, are the primary source of water for so many communities all along the stream. And it's supposed to be treated to make them fit. But treatment processes in use today were designed to take care of wastes 40 years ago. And you all by now know about some of these detergents that are supposed to get your clothes, well, not clean. Very few of them claim to get them clean anymore. They do something more marvelous than this. They get them so that you can hardly stand to look at them. And that's true, according to some of the commercials at least. And the idea is that these things are so powerful, the germs don't stand a chance, and neither does dirt. Well, neither do the water treatment plants downstream. Because this all by itself is a very serious problem. Now, that's still just a part of it, of course. But these are problems that you're aware of. You're familiar with them. But crowds, noise, and tension are listed with the other problems. The hustle and bustle of city life is itself a problem of increasing concern. The typical American city today is becoming a noisy, clanging, jangling madhouse. And exposure to city din is building up inner tensions and frustrations in people and leading them to emotional and mental disturbances and leading them, of course, to a violent and a frantic effort to escape all of the jangling, enervating noise of the city. You may not realize that fully one half of all the hospital beds in the United States are occupied by mental patients. Every other bed, and at this proportion is actually growing, that mental patients are growing to occupy more hospital beds proportionately than those for all other diseases and sicknesses. Now, what's happening is that instead of freeing up and solving the problems, bigger cities are in the offing. People are still flocking to the big cities at an unprecedented rate. And despite all the drawbacks of the difficulty in transportation, the difficulty in even trying to move through the mob to go and satisfy your desires for physical entertainment somewhere, the difficulty in getting to work on time and getting home on time, the difficulty in obtaining groceries in some areas where you find strikes and that type of thing likely, the difficulty in breathing clean air or drinking clean water, in spite of all of that, people are flocking to the big cities at an ever-increasing rate because they claim this is where the money is. 7 out of 10 Americans now live in a big urban area. That's fact. 7 out of 10. The average age, I remember reading some months ago, of the United States farmer today is 54. This has gone up in the last few years. In other words, the youngsters are leaving the farms increasingly and coming to the cities. And all of the experts agree that time is running out for the solution of these problems, and that unless something is done about it very quickly, well, your guess is as good as anybody's about what is in the offing in the future. Now, for example, in the attempts to try to free up some of the slums, or what are being called slurbs, and I'll define this in a few moments today, the sprawl of slums are torn down, and big high-rise apartments, usually subsidized by government money, are put up. But what's happening is that these giant 16-story high-rise apartments are being called virtual cell blocks by the people who live in them. Now, you take the vast Taylor Project in Chicago. It takes 5 minutes to drive past that project at 50 miles per hour. But the corridors and elevators of these giant high-rise apartment dwellings see more rapes, more muggings, and more murders than the streets which they replaced, and this is a statistical fact that the police departments can corroborate for you. Dwellers in these apartment buildings, put up for them by government money to get rid of all of our terrible slum problems, will tell you freely they would far rather have walked up and down the streets of their former slum than to go down the corridor or in the elevator or down the stairwell of their brand new government-subsidized high-rise apartment, because many of these people are living in absolute terror and fear. And it's far more difficult, obviously, to police corridors and hallways of high-rise apartment buildings than the streets that the city police used to try to keep under surveillance in the slum areas. Again, this is just one of the problems, you might say, but you put it all together and it gets into a headache of pretty giant proportions. Now, a Los Angeles Times article of a couple of years ago, and this is still true, and truer because so much time has gone by to increase the problems, talked about overpopulation and scientific progress helped by a woeful lack of planning, and how it had made a mess of cities and metropolitan regions, according to an architect planner. And he talked about how converting our cities and metropolitan regions, as we're doing today, into these high-rise urban areas, meccas of multiple-storied asphalt, concrete, aluminum, glass, and steel buildings, is doing nothing but causing a veritable hell on earth, and that ultimately he could foresee the abandonment, believe it or not, of the city altogether. That we today are succeeding in making our cities virtually unlivable. Now, I haven't talked a great deal about crime yet, but I want to talk about it for a moment. Because you can, it's almost impossible to put your finger on the pulse of a city today and to come up with any real, tangible, and accurate appraisal of just what big city life is like. But let me tell you this. If you live in a city, and the chances are you do, you are not ignorant and not unaware of your own personal problems. You know that in your pocket you carry a considerable number of keys. And the chances are you've got your blinds pulled, your drapes drawn, your doors locked, and you probably should have locked your automobile and the garage door outside. And if you want to run to the corner drugstore or the supermarket that's open late at night, you are aware that during the night, many of these same supermarkets, service stations, and drugstores are going to be robbed. A couple of close friends of mine in the past few weeks have been involved when they went in to pick something up at a package store or a drugstore or a supermarket somewhere, have been involved right in the middle of a robbery in progress, which in one case, I think somebody with a gun in his hand went roaring out and nearly knocked a man over. We're aware of this. Tomorrow morning, you're going to be hearing of the latest murders, of the latest rapes, muggings, robberies, knife fights, riots, this and that problem where somebody got mad in a bar and went home, snatched up a pistol, and came back and blew the brains out of nearly everybody in sight. You're aware of it. We might as well not kid ourselves about the problems, regardless as to the obtaining of various statistics to make it sound statistical or provable to us. But you know that there are many sections of your city, your area, where you live, where you, even as an adult, mature human being, maybe of the male sex, do not dare venture out alone at night. Increasingly, in some of our big cities, there are areas that a cab driver will not drive through for you. There are areas you will avoid like the plague. And even in your own neighborhood, the average one of you would not, right now at this moment, go outside of your home and walk a few blocks in your own neighborhood at night after dark. You just would not do it. Because we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know who's lurking around. We don't know about all of the potential beasts of some of the most hideously bestial murders that you could begin to imagine that are going to occur in the area where you live. Now, to show you, the kind of crime you read of continually would be only a sort of a repetition of what you're getting in your newspapers anyhow, but I've got a whole page full of headlines that I want you to take a look at. This happens not only in the slum areas, but you read of it in your daily newspapers every single time you pick up one with morning toast and coffee. You're reading such headlines as this and that bestial axe murder, this and that knife murder, a kidnap, another rape, some horrible crime. You can almost doubt your eyes when you read some of it. There's a berserk mother who knifes her son. A boy shoots his parents in ambush. He lays in wait for them with a rifle. Here is a sleeping man who was set aflame by some angry children. Here's a 10-year-old who blasts his whole family to death because they wouldn't buy him candy. A baby is found in a trash can, and the other day another one was found on the hood of an automobile. Here's a girl who is beheaded, of all things. A girl, 17, admits to murder. A berserk mother knifes her own son. The boy shoots his parents, as I said. Continually, you read this. Every single time you pick up a newspaper, it's almost all you can begin to see. And it's enough to make you sick. Most of our news agencies anymore are sort of a grisly collection of a series of obituaries of the night's murders and all those who have been maimed. And let me again repeat for you, as I did in a recent program, that there have been more people killed by gunshot wounds in the United States of America than there have been killed in all of our wars, including the Revolutionary War of 1776 to the very latest kill statistics from Vietnam, and that is a fact. Rising crime all by itself has been put on a par with rising communism by Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. He says it threatens the very civilization. It threatens our very society. He puts it on an absolute par with the threat of world communism. But we are right now turning our laudatory cities, our great megalopolises, into sprawling, festering, smog-bound, traffic-choked, crime-ridden cesspools of absolute violence, and they're being called a great big slurb. Now, a slurb is being defined as a sloppy, sleazy, slovenly, slipshod semi-city, and it's a pretty good tag to hang on our cities of today. But what are the solutions? What are you going to do about it? Now, you live in a city, the chances are, but why do you live there? Why did you move there in the first place? The chances are it was all by accident. But you live in the middle of a city, and you don't like some of the things you see. There are many areas, as I've said, you avoid. You have to walk with care. You shop in a certain area, always on the alert for what might be happening around you. Your little blonde daughter, if you've got one, has to be careful the route she takes home from school. More demonstrations, more riots are in the offing, more crime and all the rest of it. Now, those people who try to study today's cities and tomorrow's cities, and to try to take a step into the future, to tell you what the world tomorrow is really going to be like, have first of all gotten accurate, studied, statistical appraisals of our present generation, of our present cities and their big problems, and then have tried to put together by simple mathematical curves all of the future patterns of the big cities of tomorrow year, of the age beyond us, and to try to tell us city folks, what this world and these cities of ours are going to be like in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years. Now, certainly the epitome of all of this type of prognostication of the future has been done by the so-called Think Factory, the Hudson Institute, and the director of that institute, Dr. Herman Kahn, who is quoted in a book that I want to tell you about later, entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, by the same title of this program of The World Tomorrow that you can hear daily in your area. Dr. Kahn has pretty well summarized the feeling of all of the scientists, the technologists, of the space age scientists who are talking about the future, and they included in this all of the breakthroughs in medical science, space travel, and all of it. But here's what he talks about concerning our big cities. He says, we'll be living in a time in the 1980s of three-day weekends, 3 or 4 month vacations, Southern California-type living. But he said, along with our barbecue society, we're in for a lot of beatniks, revolutionary-type movements, and withdrawals from society. And he said, the crowded, snarled, enervating, cosmopolitan life of tomorrow, in the view of science, is rather frightening, because he talks about people living in 10-room homes with 3 cars in the garage and a helicopter on every lawn and increased income. Of course, they always talk about more and more money. But he warned that this sharp change in work patterns could be traumatic, because he said many Americans will be satisfied, but others will find such a life meaningless, empty, and purposeless, and they're going to be looking for something to fulfill them. And he said that may mean a new religion, that there will be mass movements, both rational and irrational, cults, a kind of privatism, and LSD without question. Well, we have our hippies and beatniks today, our dropouts from society, people who are already completely disgusted with the so-called establishment. Now, the frightening thing is that in the serious, studied appraisal of the people in the Think Factory of the Hudson Institute and others, and this certainly epitomizes the entire majority opinion of urban planners and of all those who are trying to look ahead in the future to tell you what your city of tomorrow year is going to be like, they tell you it's going to be just like today's cities, except everything is going to be much more so. In other words, more and more cults. More and more crime, more and more riots, more and more irrational movements, and the wider use of LSD. Now you can picture this as being your front yard. You're living now in your city, a utopian city of tomorrow year, and true to the prediction of Mr. Kahn or Dr. Kahn and so many other people like him, you're witnessing an LSD love-in on your front yard. I ask you, my friends, are these predictions for tomorrow's cities really good? Are the predictions about tomorrow year of our vast, complex, sprawling megalopolises, are they really good? You may not like to face the facts that whether you talk about smog control, whether you talk about clean water and clean food, whether you talk about all the transportation problems, whether it's the overcrowded conditions, whether it's providing sufficient housing, whether it's providing sufficient jobs, whether it's solving the problems of so-called downtrodden areas like Bedford-Stuyvesant and Watts and the infamous now centers of riots of the big cities of yesteryear and as we're being warned of today and tomorrow in the future, whether you try to talk about the racism, whether you talk about the giant problems of waste disposal, regardless as to which aspect of it you try to decipher and you try to uncover it, you try to drag out and to understand in any accurately appraisable terms, you can only admit with me or anybody else who wants to think about it that this is completely untenable. Well, I'm going to have to tell you more about it next time and in a series of two programs on The World Tomorrow, tell you exactly what the cities of tomorrow are predicted to be like and what they are really going to be like in an appraisal that you have never before read that is going to give you the real truth about what tomorrow's cities will be like in this booklet by the same name as this program, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. Now also these free booklets that I've announced from time to time on Does God Exist? And the one entitled The Proof of the Bible. They're both free of charge. There's no price for them, and there is no price for the Plain Truth magazine. 52 pages, absolutely filled with pictures, some of them the most remarkable close-up color photography in our science lab that you have ever seen about some of these strange creatures. And in the current number, this article on Go to the Ant. You know that scientists for years thought Solomon was wrong? They thought that when Solomon said that ants actually gathered their food in the summer and stored it up for the winter, that this was utterly wrong. It couldn't be true. Well, it is true, and this article shows you it's true, and they've discovered there are harvesting ants, and that, too, is a great blow to the theory of evolution. So the article on the ants, every single number in the Plain Truth, articles on that subject. They're absolutely free of charge. There is no price for them. No one's going to call on you. There is no follow-up. Your name is carefully kept in our modern IBM files. It's not given to someone else. There is no bill to follow. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember the booklets, the article I mentioned, are absolutely free. There is no charge. The Plain Truth comes along free of charge, no cost, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. And so until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.